When I was a teenager, I mowed the front lawn in the summers with a push mower. I liked the task because it was boring and it gave me time to think. I don't remember exactly what I needed so much time to think about. I was teaching myself computer programming, so I know designing the next program I would write or trying to figure out why the program I just wrote wouldn't run was the subject of some of my thinking. I remember distinctly one particular day I mowed. This would have been after I finished high school and I was taking a couple of college classes in the summer from the local community college. The classes weren't very hard. I know this because I missed 6 weeks of them and still got A's. I missed them because I was mowing. Mowing, that is, on one particular day. On the day I decided partway through that I had to quit, and I went inside and laid down on the old brown couch in the living room. When I woke up a couple of hours later, I felt no better, and I knew something was wrong. Taxonomy is the practice of giving names to things. Once we have names for things, we can think about them in different ways and sense different things we couldn't sense before. With no name for what was wrong, I had trouble describing it. I was tired, but not sleepy or fatigued. I was uncomfortable, but not in pain. I wasn't going to throw up, but I felt vaguely like you do when you will. With the diagnosis at the emergency room, I could be more specific. My breathing wasn't working. It felt like there was a weight pulling on the stuff located in the right side of my chest. I had a collapsed lung. Why it collapsed, they didn't know exactly. Maybe there were little bubbles on the outside and one of them popped. That was the best explanation they could give. The treatment was to insert a rubber tube between two of my ribs and connect it to a suction pump until it sucked the lung back into place. The tube and pump had to stay there until the leak stopped. It would take 3 weeks, it turned out. Then, about 4 weeks later, it happened again. This time they injected some caustic substance to scar up the chest wall and the lung and glue them together. I said the treatment was to insert a tube between two ribs. It was really to ram a tube between two ribs. The doctor told me that he wouldn't be giving me an anesthetic. Instead, he would just use a scalpel to make a cut in my skin and then push the hose in so hard it would make a hole between the ribs. That shouldn't take more than 15 seconds, he said. If it took longer than 15 seconds, it would be a real problem. It sounded to me at the time that this would be a real problem anyway, but the doctor explained that as soon as he was done, he would give me an injection of a drug that would cause me to lose all memory of the last 15 seconds. This, he said, was far safer than anesthetic for such a quick procedure. So let me get this right, I said with half my breath. You're going to cut me with a scalpel while I'm completely awake and aware of what's going on, shove a tube in my side as hard as you can, and I'm not going to remember that you've done it? That's right. Why is it that I'm going to let you do this? Why won't I fight back? Because you trust me, he said. And because you'll be restrained. This didn't sound like a good idea to me. It seemed like a bad idea. It also seemed like a great example of a practical philosophical question. What are the ethics of inflicting pain on someone who isn't going to remember it? Emotionally, this was an easier question to contemplate. Surely, this was a bad thing, to operate on an awake patient. Yet the doctor was doing it for my good. My lung had collapsed, and I needed intervention. He had not collapsed my lung. He was not going about looking for people to cut open with a sharp knife and stab with a dull hose. He was aiding me. Intervening some other way, by using general anesthetic, would pose more risk for me. Frankly, this contemplative reaction didn't last very long. I was more concerned about whether he was really right, whether I really would forget about it. If I didn't, there would be no backup plan and no way of undoing it. Yet it seemed odd that whether it worked or not, exactly the same things would have happened. So if it's going to happen to me anyway, why would it be so bad if I remembered it? Do all your patients just let you operate on them with the promise that you'll make them forget their pain? I asked. He smiled. Trust me. There is a segment of time It begins in an operating room, being moved from a gurney to a hard table. It ends with the whirring of a pump. That segment is missing. It is as though it never occurred. I know it did, but only because I saw its effects. Some days I wonder if they really gave me an anesthetic and whether the doctor was just having some fun. But that's a question that doesn't really matter to me very much. What matters to me is that either way the result is really the same. But some days I wonder what else might have happened during the segment of time. What if I won the lottery? What if the nurse told the funniest joke I would ever hear? What if just before the surgeon took his knife in his hand, someone who loved me slipped into the room and held mine? It would be one thing to have just missed these things completely. Certainly I have missed winning the lottery and am none the worse for it. But it would be another thing entirely to have experienced, to have been moved by them, but to have lost the experience. When I was a boy, perhaps 9 or 10, I don't remember now because it wasn't important at the time, we lived down the road from the Scotts, two spinster sisters and their older deaf bachelor brother, who was 90. One of the Scott sisters had gone senile and spent her days making the bed over and over. She was content when she was fitting the sheets, fluffing the pillow, and spreading out the quilt she'd made 50 years before. Her life, to her, seemed to have as much meaning as anyone else's I knew. As she folded back the corner each time, I figured she had a sense of place and of accomplishment. She knew just what her calling was and had perfected it. So I didn't understand why, once in the nursing home, they felt it necessary to strap her down and leave her quilt stored neatly on a shelf where she could see it, but not touch it. I used to wonder what the big deal was about senility. If you were senile, you wouldn't know it. You wouldn't know that you weren't really William Shakespeare or the King of Siam. You would be unaware that your upkeep required money or that your grown children were already fighting over who would own your furniture when you passed on. More importantly, if you were senile, there would be a lot of painful things you'd no longer be forced to remember. If your spouse had gone before you, there would be no daily reminders anymore when you pick up a crossword puzzle that hadn't been done or looked at pictures that were now faded by sunlight. The flag tightly folded in a triangle shape that sat in the top shelf of the linen closet would no longer transport you back to the horror of a wartime telegram when you pull out a towel to dry your hair. The lingering tensions of conflicts unresolved between friends or family, or of words often thought but never spoken, would disappear. Senility could erase those things that time alone could not, I thought. So when I saw Miss Scott, I wondered if senility would be a relief. I used to wonder what the big deal was about senility. But I'm marginally wiser now. The irony of senility as a relief from our pains and fears is that we can't realize that the relief has come because we have no memory of what we're relieved from. We can't appreciate finding place and accomplishment. I know now what I did not fully see as a boy, that senility takes from others left to care for and protect the infirm. And more importantly, it takes the things we wish to hold on to the most tightly, as well as those we want most to pass from memory. And often, those things are one and the same.